To see examples of what we talked about on the show, along with further information, go to bunchofdorks.com. Hello, I'm Don Moore, and you're listening to Two Dimension, a comic book podcast in no direction. And sitting across from me is a man that is not level-headed, but...
He's Al. Dr. Morbius.
From parts unknown.
From parts unknown. Split personality. How the hell are you, Don?
I'm good.
Yeah, so what do we do on this show? I'm gonna do like a mile. What do we do? What do we talk about? Comics. We talk about comic book related. We talk about the Navy. We talk about anything on this show. It's worth a free for all.
Yeah, if you listen to episode 90, I apologize. You had to listen to 8 or 9 minutes of shipboard life, which
it was interesting.
But
did Company I say anything about it?
Yeah, he listened to the episode, but he didn't say anything about the Navy.
He didn't say anything about it? Okay. Well, but,
it is a comic book podcast. That's what we talk about, but we get off subject all the time and talk about stuff that you probably wouldn't want to listen to if it was a podcast about those.
Occasionally, we have two other members, the younger half. Would be Dallas and Rook. I think they'll be on the next episode, so it'll be almost the entire team, but then you won't be on the next
yeah,
one, right?
That's scheduling problems. I can't be on that time.
Yeah, so one day we'll get all four of us together again for one of those rare. It wasn't rare at the beginning though. It was pretty continuous, but then it's just kinda like, you know.
I love it when we're all together. It's fun.
Yeah, it's kinda fun. It's kinda fun to see Rook like get angry at the at the comic books and throw them around. That was great on that last episode.
Yeah,
was so unexpected. I was like, man, okay, tell us how you really feel, dude. But we'll be hearing from him in a couple of days, so it should be interesting.
Yeah, The Walking Dead is the one I can't get past.
Yeah, he gave up on it. He's angry.
Well,
with
it, the storyline. It was the storyline.
Nothing happened. Nobody got killed.
But yeah, as we said on the show, I couldn't believe he's saying. I've never heard him say anything but just glowing praise about it. But
after 130 issues, that book's been going on for like 10 years, I think. Now,
has it really?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
I tell you, I do like the fact that it's so successful and it's owned by the creator. You know.
Yeah.
I love that. You know,
yeah,
I like
to
see that.
Well, he did the Marvel Zombies too, didn't he, Kirkman? So he's like the zombie guy.
Really?
I got a feeling that he did the Marvel Zombies books for, you know, obviously Marvel. I don't know if they were around the same time as The Walking Dead. They might have been. But, yeah, I got a feeling that he was involved in that. So he's like Mr. Zombie dude. And we talked about it before. There have been other zombie books in the past in the 80s. There was the Living Dead, I think, or something.
There was a bunch of zombie stuff.
Yeah. And there was actually, I found it the other day in the garage, too, but it got damaged. Unfortunately, there was actually in the 80s or the early 90s another book called The Walking Dead about zombies. I'm pretty sure.
You talked about that was an old book.
Yeah. And it just maybe did a few issues. It was a black and white.
Hmm.
Even though The Walking Dead is a black and white, it might be the most popular black and white book since The Turtles.
Probably so.
Maybe I think it's probably surpassed The Turtles in a lot of ways.
Yeah, I think so. The Turtles, what I was talking about, the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. They were popular, but it's when the cartoon show came on. That's when it really
took off.
I mean, within comic circles, I guess, you know, it was a good property. People were always buying the books up and stuff, but I didn't see the books all that often, you know, rarely. But I know it was always talked about. But then when they put the cartoon show out and they started selling the action figures at the store, and next thing you know, you'd buy a frozen pizza in and have the turtles on it and stuff. That's when it really hit it. But
yeah, that's when it became. It was big because of the controversy at the beginning, and then people wanted it and they were buying it. But yeah, when it hit the hysteria, when it hit Turtle Mania, is when the TV show came on, and then the movies got made and all that kind of stuff. And
you know, The first time I ever saw the Turtles, Amazing Heroes from Fantagraphics used to put out the year in the review. They'd have all the previews in this one special magazine.
Yeah, sure. I remember I have some of those.
And it was I guess it was the second, maybe third issue of it. And I was waiting for the bus, and I was just thumbing through it, and it said Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. I thought that's so stupid, and they had an image of a little tiny image. But I just kind of glanced at it, and I just, that's so stupid. It was a joke because the Teen Titans were a really popular comic book, so Teenage Mutant was the X-Men. Ninja was everything Frank Miller did had ninjas in it, which most of the Western audience didn't know what a ninja was till Daredevil had them. And then Turtles, I thought, okay, this is stupid. Well, then I go overseas. I come back 9 months later. I go to, in Hawaii, I find a comic store. I buy a bunch of books. I get a couple of Amazing Heroes. And there's a big article about those two guys. And then they have this picture of them among all these stacks of the first issue. And the caption is Eastman and Laird surrounded by the precious first issue, like it was some holy grail. I thought, what? Because, like I said, I thought the book was silly. Come to find out, I guess it hit and it sold out, and everybody's just clamoring for it. And so I always saw it from afar. I just never paid much attention to it. And then the cartoon came on, and they were talking about all the big plans they had for it. Like I said, it got huge. Dallas Rook, all these guys.
They grew up on it, probably.
I never cared for it. My brother, as a joke, sent me a Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle calendar for, I guess, 1988. And I looked at it. And I don't know. To me, everyone was all the same. It was just a turtle standing there. Eastman and Laird drew them. But Dallas brought in a big trade of like the first 10 or 12 issues of it. I have to admit, it's pretty good.
You read them, okay.
I actually didn't read the stories. I just thumbed through it. But like I said, the calendars are just the turtles in the same poses all the time. But what really got me was the buildings they drew, and there were some where, like, I'm butchering all this, but there was one drawing, there's an aerial shot of the top of a building, and I don't know if it was one of the turtles or another character climbing over it. It was pretty neat. It didn't look the same as a lot of. Later, they started hiring a lot of other cartoonists to do the
Yeah.
stories, and they were good. I remember Ken Mitrunny was doing some for
I think Richard Corbin even did some work
a while.
for them.
But those first, like that trade Dallas had, he said actually he loved those. Him and Rook, that was the ones they liked, and it had a rustic look, and it was unique. I didn't see translated to the cartoons or the other stuff.
What you mean the TV? The TV cartoons is
Yeah,
what
the
you're talking
TV
about? Oh,
cartoon.
yeah, they usually homogenize it
But
the
one
same.
thing about those guys, like I don't think in the original stuff they had pizza. The cartoons, those guys were always, everything was pizza related.
I never watched the cartoons either.
Well, you couldn't help see commercials and stuff for frozen pizza places,
And
and
they were doing them,
all the toys, they had pizza shooters and stuff like that. And I think the Turtlemobile, my nephews had this stuff. I think the Turtlemobile had it shot pizzas or something. But I was reading about those guys. They said that, I guess basically when the cartoon companies and marketing people came forward, they were trying to do things the kids could relate to. And the Turtles originally, all four of them had red masks. The only way you could tell them apart was the weapons they used. And so I guess with the cartoon, either the toy company, somebody, but they had the mask differentiated. I guess one had a blue mask, orange mask, there was a red one, and maybe a purple one. But I said, yeah, okay, that's fine. And then they introduced the pizza, and those guys were like, yeah, sure, that's fine. They weren't like micromanaging everything, and
No.
all this stuff became it was a smart choice to it. On the same subject, I will say, the new show they have, which I guess is computer generated, maybe.
They have a new show?
Yeah, they had a show. I don't know if it's still on, but I liked the turtle design of that. As a matter of fact, at Dallas's practice shed that we were at, on the bar, they have all four turtles, and
Oh,
it's
I
from
never
that
saw
cartoon.
that.
But it's a neat shape and a neat design. And I, if it came out like that in the 80s, I probably would have liked the turtles quite a bit. So.
I just remember like that might have been the first black and white explosion comic book. That was one that started that boom. Yeah, and then they had all the imitations and all hell broke loose, as they say.
But there was black and white books before that.
Well, yeah, there was Love and Rockets and Creepy and Eerie and
Well,
all that, but
Creepy and Eerie was around, and Vampirella and all that, but in the late 70s, that's when ElfQuest and Cerebus
yeah.
both came out, and those were really popular books. ElfQuest was one of my favorites.
And Final Kingdom that we talked about, but
Oh yeah,
they're
the First Kingdom.
the first Kingdom, but they were almost like undergrounds in a way.
Yeah.
There was the black and white books, the original ones were the underground comics because they couldn't whatever afford to do
Well, but
color, I don't know.
Cerebus and ElfQuest, they were making money. Those people were earning their living doing it.
Oh yeah.
And then there was other books, Flaming Carrot, by Bob Burden.
That was before the
Yeah, it was
Turtles?
before the Turtles, and Reed Fleming, World's Toughest
That was
Milkman.
before the Turtles?
Yeah, it was
Really?
before the Turtles. That was all in 84.
Okay.
Earlier. And what was it, Normal Man? That was out.
So who was doing the black and white books? Was it like before the Turtles? Was it First Comics
Was
or
Aardvark Dinah Aardvark.
Aardvark? Oh, it was her, Denny LuBert and David Sim.
Yeah,
Okay.
I'm trying to think. I
Well,
don't
there
know
was
if.
Starreach. That was, but that was almost like an again. That was like an underground
Yeah,
almost.
Starreach. That wasn't sold in the newsstands. Yeah, Starreach came, which we talked about in the past. That was in the late 70s.
Oh no, that was, I bought an issue of Starreach at my first convention that I went to in 1974.
Yeah, well, mid 70s, I guess. I started seeing them. There was a comic store that opened up in Oklahoma City called Down Memory Lane, and that was in 1977, and that's where I first started seeing Starreach. So yeah, you're right. They were mid 70s, but I was,
You didn't maybe get them until a year or two later.
yeah, and I was continuing to buy them all the way up to 1980 at these comic stores, but they were old issues. But they had people like Barry Smith, Neil Adams, Dick Giordano, trying to think, Alan Weiss, Steve Laiolola.
Well, yeah, they were dig. Those are guys that did fanzines, and
Yeah.
they did black Marvel black and white books.
Well, and some of the four color books too.
Yeah,
Mike
yeah,
Volsberg. And
yeah.
again, as we talked about in the
Because they
past
were doing more
episode,
adult things.
yeah, Lee Mars, it was great.
Oh, yeah, I forgot about Lee Mars,
You know,
yeah.
every time I bought those books, I would get so upset seeing Lee Mars in it, thinking, this woman can't draw. I hate her. Why are they putting her in here? She was in every issue. And next thing you know, she was the reason I was buying the book. Once you read the stories, this woman's a genius. And she became my favorite. And I guess she went into political cartoons and storyboards and other things.
No, I don't even know. I know who
But
she is, but I don't remember her work.
it's
Didn't have
funny.
that impression with me.
Yeah, well, like I said at the beginning, I just despise the fact she's in it. And then later, nothing but good things about Lee Mars. I'm sorry I was so stubborn at the beginning.
And Trina Robbins and
Yeah.
people like that.
Yeah, a lot of underground people and stuff. But, like I said, Neil Adams, Craig Russell, P. Craig Russell, he had stuff in it.
Okay. Well, he was working for Marvel first, wasn't he?
Yeah, well, a bunch of those guys, Dick Giordano and Neil Adams, were with DC and
They
Marvel.
well, they did work for Starreach
Yeah.
and Wits End too, which is a fanzine.
Yeah. Yeah, Starreach kind of went on where Wits End kind of stopped.
Yeah, I mean there is maybe there is a connection. I never really thought about it, but yeah, kind of. But to me, Starreach at the beginning was kind of like Jim Starlin,
That's
Chaykin.
right. He was in there too, and
Yeah,
Howard
like
Chaykin.
early Cody Starbuck, I think might have even
Yeah,
been.
I had one of those.
In the first Starreach that I got, and I know Starlin was in it, so that was almost like a comic book version of a fan. It was kind of like the in between a fanzine and a full color book, because you had professionals working there, but it wasn't really sold at newsstand. So it was still kind of like an underground comic book. The Turtles, I guess, made it more popularly acceptable for that medium, the black and white comic book, to be sold.
Yeah, well, after the Turtles happened, there was,
Floodgates.
yeah, and like I said, there was a lot of black and white books before that, but I don't know. Yeah, it opened the floodgates and it just saturated the market. I remember there was a comic book called Gnat Trap. I never read it, but I saw it. It looked like a fat, cartoony Batman. And I remember the first couple of issues, he was basically taking the Dark Knight covers and just drawing this character on it.
That
That's
was
it on it.
before the Turtles?
No, after the Turtles.
Oh yeah, and then there was adolescent,
Adolescent radioactive black belt hamsters.
then there was stuff like Boris the Bear,
Yeah.
and then the like I said, every company like and everybody with a few bucks started up their own comic book company, and for a while there, that was floating the market. That caused like a big upswing back in the late 80s till it kind of died out a little bit, and then and then now we're kind of like seeing a resurgence of like the 90s with all the gimmicky covers with the DC books, but that's a whole nother story for another time. Whenever, well, I guess they're coming out in September, so, and I guess they're going to be doing a lot more changes to the DC universe, so I guess that's a yearly thing.
Do you read any of those books? Do
No, I
you?
don't read any of the New 52 or the old 52. I don't know what they call them now, but I'll pick up a few if I like the art on them, but I never really followed the storyline or anything.
I never had, honestly, I didn't care what they did. I heard people complain about the new 52. I've heard people carry on about it. It was great. I just never saw any books I liked except when they did OMAC, Keith
Yeah,
Giffen,
and that
and
didn't last.
yeah, it was 10 issues. And it's funny, I really enjoyed that. I deeply enjoyed that book. And then some website was talking about the new 52, and the first thing the guy says, "Well, I can tell you one book that's not going to last, OMAC." And to him, it was the complete opposite of what I said. But to me, I really like Jack Kirby's book in the 74. But this one I enjoyed just as much. I thought it was pretty clever. Well, no, I read Batwoman. I don't know if that was a B-52 or New 52, B-52.
Batwoman was yeah, she was a B-52. Yeah, no, she was one of the big 52. Yeah.
But I read those when
Well,
J.H.
they
Williams was
renumbered
doing them.
everything. That's what the deal was. I think I said everything got number ones.
Yeah, so I looked at two of the books, but I don't mind what they do. If they want to make gimmicky covers, it's fine as long as people are reading the material. In the 90s, to me, what made it bad was people were buying books and then not even touching them, not reading them. And it's like what you said, these guys are going into buying 20 issues of something, and they come back thinking that they could just sell it for something else when the price went up.
But the 90s seem to be getting trashed a lot as like a really bad era for comics. And I do have a bunch, and I can attest that there was a lot of like substandard artwork in them, and maybe the writing wasn't up to, but there was still a bunch of good stuff around. I
Oh
guess you had
yeah.
to look around, at least got to dig around for it. And the same goes for today, but the 90s gets the bad rap as a bad era for comic books. I don't know why. I think everything has good and bad in it. You have to just kind of like look around a little bit.
Oh, I completely agree. And that's something I've always said was that when I think of the 90s, I didn't read all these books that were the hot books, but there was a lot of stuff. That's when Alan Davis was doing Excalibur by himself, which that was one of my favorite books. And Usagi Jimbo was still going strong.
Oh, yeah, right.
Love and Rockets was coming out. And of course, during the 90s is when they changed it and they stopped doing the magazine size and were doing separate comic books for a while.
Yeah, didn't they go to regular size comic books with the Love and Rocket stuff for
Yeah,
a while?
they did 50 issues of the big magazine black and white comic.
Okay.
And then their reasoning was is that they said comic book fans like to have lower numbers, and they were already up to 50. So
Okay.
they said they were going to start over, but it wasn't going to be Love and Rockets. They said each brother was going to just do their own stuff, comic book size, which a lot of people were kind of scratching their heads about, because the only reason you leave something you're doing that's successful is if you want to do it on your own. And Fantagraphics let those guys do whatever they wanted. I mean, it was the perfect format. They had a magazine that people knew and read.
I just think people don't want to read magazines because it maybe it doesn't fit in their comic book boxes. I don't know.
Well, that's when they split up, and I know Jaime did that series you like, Whoa, Nelly.
Yeah, that was good.
And then
The wrestling
Gilbert,
thing.
man, Gilbert did a bunch. He did New Love, Girl Crazy. It seemed to me like Gilbert had three or four different books all at once.
Yeah, we talked about it before that. He basically overextended himself.
Well, I think
And he realized it.
one reason they wanted to split was Gilbert would get things done and wait for Jaime. So I guess he felt, I'm guessing,
Oh,
this
okay.
isn't what he said, this is what I'm saying. But I think maybe he thought he could put out more books and do better. And he did put out more books, but I find I didn't like them as much. And then later, in some interview, which I think you saw in the Carolinas, but he said that I thought if you put out more books, you make more money, and that's not the case. Well, you know, but that's what they split up, and then after a while, they got back together and did Love and Rockets. It was a comic book size, you know, still black and white. And now they are doing Love and Rockets news stories, which are kind of a square format book they put out once a year.
That is so weird. Just once a year.
But it's a year's worth of stories. So basically, like if you just waited to buy all the magazines they did, that's what it come out for. They've done, I think, six. I've got them. They're fantastic, you
But they're
know.
smaller size. They're comic book size.
You like that trade you bought, that Esperanza or whatever?
Right. That's a year's worth of material.
Yeah.
See, that's good, and but it's not good in the sense that you even though it's a year's worth of material, you're gonna read it in like 2 days. Then what do you do for the rest of the year?
Well,
I guess you could keep looking at it. But to me, it was like the joy of the comic book was that every month you'd get another one. You'd
well,
read it pretty quickly, but you'd get another one. But now it's just like, okay, I'm done now. Now what? You go on to another comic book,
Love and
obviously.
Rockets was never on schedule. I know in the beginning, I think it was supposed to come out bi-monthly. It was never bi-monthly. And then they changed it to where it'd come out 3 times a year. And at one point, it's still in the mid-80s, like 85.
Oh, really? Never came out?
Yeah. And
Oh,
then
okay.
in 85, in the Indica, it said, Love and Rockets is a work of art, and when it's done, it'll come out. And, you know, which I never minded. I wanted more, but, you know, as long as I got some, I was happy.
Okay, I didn't realize it was that infrequent.
So, and like I said, you know, sometimes Gilbert does side work, you know, Fatima and some of that stuff outside of Love and Rockets. So, you know, it's all good.
Yeah, there's plenty of stuff out there. But I mean, basically you're just going to see both of their works for the most part once a year.
Once a year. But like I said, if you like that, you can go buy all the back matter that they've done over the years since
Sure, there's plenty
82.
of it. 20 something years
Yeah, and
of it.
I'll tell you, it's all worth it. Some of the stuff is experimental and you might not, but it's all together. It's just all nothing but wonderful.
Did you ever notice some of the quirks and similarities with Jaime Hernandez and Alex Toth?
Name some.
Just take a look at the artwork. I was drawing the other day, and I was like kind of doing like an imitation, trying to do an imitation Alex Toth style, and some of it came out looking a little bit like Jaime Hernandez. And then I saw something there. I go, oh, okay, the simplicity.
Yeah.
The design, some of the characters. There's definitely like a connection to that I never made before. I was always making the Dan DiCarlo connection, but there's an Alex Toth thing going on there too.
Right.
That's like, tell us if there's a little more. He's different. He had a little more texture to his style, maybe more brushwork or whatever. Where Jaime looks like he's using a lot of markers and stuff like
Yeah.
that.
No, I well, whenever we talk about artists that gets, you know, the basic form gets simpler as they get older. Of course, we always mention both
No, but I
Alex
mean
Toth
even
and
early,
Jaime.
not I mean not now. I mean even earlier, his work. There's a big Toth thing going on there, which I should have known, but I never really realized it until like this weird thing happened. I was like, huh, okay, I can see it now. Yeah.
Yeah, well, it's in the Dan DiCarlo thing on Jaime Hernandez is really strong, but I guess the only difference I'd see was Alex Toth. His
Patterns and design. Patterns and
Yeah,
designs.
exactly, patterns and design. And like I said,
And simplicity.
when you work simply, you have to have a stronger image. You have to have a stronger foundation. So that's why their compositions, their form was really strong. And but I guess the one big difference is Alex Toth stuff, and it looked a little fluid.
It was more fluid. Yes, it
It
was,
had
and spontaneous and like scratchy at times.
bold, thicker lines. Whereas Jaime, his stuff is a little bit more static.
It
When I say
is.
that, you still see movement in it, but it's a little more static, and it's usually a single line weight, which is something I don't normally like, but I do like it when he does it.
Yeah.
So it's a little more
Toth has done stuff that's a simpler line way too, because his style was always changing. You can always see the design. You could always see it was Toth, but the technique and the materials would change all the time with Alex Toth. If you look at Zorro and you look at Bravo for Adventure, you can see two different sides of the same coin there.
Yeah, it's well. Whenever I say, and when I say this, I love them both, but I
Yeah.
always see Alex Toth as more rough and ready, whereas Jaime was a little bit more clinical and sterile. But
Yeah.
when I'm saying that, that sounds ugly. I love them
No, I
both.
don't think I don't think sterile is the right word. I just think he's a little more like I can't even think of the right word. He's just more static.
Okay, static. Forget the other word I said.
Yeah, sterile has a net negative, you know. And let's take a break now and play some music, and we'll be right back after this musical break.
I've never seen you looking so bad, my funky one. You tell me that your super bad mind has come undone. And it made you do what half a heart surely will tell you, my friend.
You can hear our most recent 20 episodes on iTunes. If you want to hear our older episodes, you can find them at our blog on bunchofdorks.com.
And that was one of my favorite bands, Wilco, doing a cover of one of my favorite bands, Steely Dan, with "Any Major Dude with Half a Heart Surely Will Tell You, My Friend." Great song.
I've never liked
You never
Steely
like
Dan.
Steely Dan, the
No.
Dan? Not even the early stuff, but it was more rock.
I did like the early stuff. I liked, Reelin' in the Years and Ricky Don't Lose That Number. And there was
Those are great songs,
that was the
yeah.
first album. Well, yeah, but then they started, I don't know.
They got real polished.
Yeah, too polished and clinical. And I don't know, just too sterile to me.
But here's the thing somebody said, and it was a really interesting quote. It was like, they made their sound really polished and sterile, but the subject matter wasn't. So it was kind of like, it was like the most kind of weird AOR stuff you could find out there, you know. It was like kind of like a combination of the two. It's like, wow, this is really like, easy jazz, but then when you listen to what they're singing about, you go, really? Okay, so.
Yeah, well, I've been surrounded by people that absolutely worship them.
But I do like the early stuff better. I like the first three or four albums. I like up until Katie Lied. And then Royal Scam's good, and Asia was the one where they changed completely into like a jazz R&B, and I do like the.
Well, that's supposed to be the crown jewel of all their albums is Asia.
It's not my favorite, but I do like it a lot.
This guy I worked for was so heavily into him, he convinced me, so I went and bought it, and I thought, why did I waste all, $7 on this?
It's a good record, though. It's got some good songs on it, but yeah, it's pretty jazzy and hipster and L.A. sounding.
It's kind of like watching grass grow.
I don't know. You're being too tough on him.
Well, no.
Whatever. But you still like the early stuff better.
Yeah,
so that's good.
Mark Agnola lent me, I don't know what it was called. It was a run through. And it was basically them playing, again, all these songs later on, which I didn't like. But they were playing them like their first album, Life. And it was just, it wasn't a show. It was just them, I guess, running through it.
And it sounded more live to
you. Oh, I loved it. And it was awesome. And they were a great band, great musicians, great songs. But again, it was just.
Did it get a little too sterile on that album?
Yeah, absolutely. I keep saying clinical and sterile, but you can't.
That's the theme for today's show, clinical and sterile.
If you understand, Walter Becker.
Yeah.
I guess after they broke up, I read about him in Musician Magazine, and he was living in Hawaii, and he was basically just trying to stay out on the beach as much as he could, and they were talking about with Steely Dan, him and Donald Fagen was living in the studio, sometimes never seeing the sun. And just constantly editing and going through tapes and polishing. And, again, that's what it sounds like.
They would actually have a song and get a group of musicians to play it. And then if they didn't like it, they'd gather together another group of musicians to play the same song. And then after, I don't know how many different teams decide which ones they wanted. That's especially true with Asia. And the one that came after Asia, which I can't think, Gaucho. But the first four have a little bit more of a rockin' soulful feel to them.
Yeah.
The first three especially are like, the first four. Pretzel Logic, the one with Ricky Don't Lose That Number, that is a great record.
Oh, that's the big one.
That is a great record.
Yeah, that was
not
all
a
before.
Bad song in that record.
That was all before they started beating the life and interest out of everything and making it squeaky clean. No, thank you.
Everything has its, squeaky queen, or squeaky clean, not squeaky, or squeaky Frome from Charles Manson fame, but anyway.
No, we're not mentioning him on this show.
We're not going there. We're just talking about comic books.
There
we're not
go.
Talking about Charles Manson comic
Although
books
we're talking
anything.
About Steely Dan for the past 8 minutes.
And they were kind of like, mischievous fellows back in the day, but, the thing about them too, just for another minute, they broke up for like 10 years, but they've been together touring in there for the last like 25 or 30. So they just broke up for a little short period of time, relatively speaking, after, they broke up in the early 80s and came back together like by 90 and were touring again. So it wasn't that long of a breakup.
Well, of course, because all these bands become cover bands themselves and they tour to make money.
That's where you make money these days.
So,
How do you think a lot of the comic book artists are making money these days? They're touring and making money selling sketches.
Well, that and doing commissions of work
and doing commissions,
that they've
done
or other people have done.
Yeah, so, doing commissions of Commissioner Gordon and things like that. So let's talk about comics, man. What do you got to say? Should I talk about two comic books that I'm...
Let's do it.
Okay. Well, this one here is first finished with the first... whatever you want to call it, arc
Afterlife.
Of Afterlife with Archie, and it's got a pretty good ending, actually. They escape from Riverdale. I can't do the spoiler alert thing.
Yeah.
I'm not going to tell you the ending, but the guy came up with a really good way of getting them out of the mansion. They were trapped in the Veronica Lodge mansion, and the zombies were like as a la Night of the Living Dead and getting ready to get them, but they were able to escape. I mean, they lost a lot of people. I mean, I think Archie... Betty Veronica are still there, Mr. Lodge,
well, of course.
Butler, Reggie, Kevin Keller, maybe Sabrina, but Jughead's gone, and a lot of the other guys. The parents are gone.
How many issues did that run?
It's going to keep going. This is the first arc, so this is five.
Okay.
That's it. And then they're going to start up another storyline. And then I guess, not I guess, I know, that they're doing a Sabrina book along the lines of this with a different, with another actor called, another actor, another artist called Robert Hack, who's pretty good too. So that's going to be coming out.
Well, is this
soon.
Afterlife still going to be Francavilla?
I think so. I'm not sure.
Wow.
But the trade's out. It's, I saw it at Pat's at Comics World the other day. So the trade's out. And I might have to get it because it's got all the variant covers, and it's also got a lot of the preliminary drawings for the pages, you know.
Yeah, which is nice.
So that stuff kind of like seals the deal for you. But yeah, I thought he ended this storyline pretty good, better than I, you know. I was like, what the hell are they going to do? And yeah, good for them. Cheers, as they say.
So you recommend it to other people?
I recommended it to Rook, but I don't know if he really got on it or not. But the trade's out now, so.
Well, he's only going to read it if it's recommended from that lady at Yancey, because that's the only one he listens
from,
to.
Oh, from that girl that works there or whatever. Yeah, okay, well, hey. This is a strange book, The Superior Foes of Spider-Man. Now, I haven't been reading. I just picked up this issue because I like the cover.
Yeah, I do too.
And, you know, I'm picking up a storyline in the middle, but I'll just tell you, by reading it, what's going on. In a seriously twisted and not terribly intelligent scheme, Boomerang left the Sinister Six, stole the painting of Dr. Doom with his mask off from the Owl, got the painting stolen from him by the Chameleon, and managed to convince the Owl that the Chameleon was the original thief. Fresh off this success, Boomerang was confronted by ex-teammate Beetle, Overdrive, and a souped-up school bus full of children and armed to the teeth. Public education ain't what it used to be. So you can tell what this is, goofiness, but it's kind of a fun book. I enjoy it. It's the basically they're still going that storyline or whatever. The artist Steve Lever is pretty good art. And there's one panel that is an homage to Jaime Hernandez. Let me find this panel for you because you'll see it and you'll go, oh yeah, I remember what issue that was from. So it's a cool book. I'm going to have to like investigate previous issues and see if I can, you know, pick up on the storyline. But it definitely has that Adult Swim type humor, if that's what you, snarky, I think is the word. So if you like that, like that's like a Jaime Hernandez panel right there.
Yeah.
I've seen that panel before, but it's a fun book and I kind of like it. So I'd recommend it.
Pretty good.
I recommend it. So yeah, those are the two ones that I did this week, but yeah, definitely Afterlife with Archie's. I think it's definitely worthwhile. Get the trade.
Is Spider-Man in this book at all?
Not that I know of. I mean, this is the only issue I've ever bought. I like doing that. I like going to the store and picking up an issue and just go, oh, this art grabs me. Let me read it. And then now I have to go and like investigate what happened. It's a Superior Foes of Spider-Man, so I'm assuming at some point he'll show up in it, but it's all his.
Yeah.
It looks like it's Daredevil's, nemesis, too, like the Owl and the Beetle and stuff like that. But, yeah, Hammerhead's in there, and, there's a bunch of them.
It's funny you mentioned some of these. You brought up a few points I wanted to talk about. One was the Owl. As I said on that one show, Daredevil 3, he's in it. And the Owl was always, to me, just this crummy.
It was
crummy.
The Owl and Mr. Hyde, right? They were teamed up together.
Were they?
I think I seem to remember those two. But,
well, I just remember, and I do like how Gene Colan drew the Owl, but I just thought it's just a guy with a funny haircut and a big coat. You know, I don't know. I never thought he was a good character, but in that Daredevil issue 3, the build-up to him and how they did him, it was really scary and really neat. And he's kind of like a crime boss.
Okay.
But the way the story went and how they put it together and set up the whole thing, I like the character. But I guess it's kind of like, I never thought Kingpin was much till Frank Miller started putting him in Daredevil.
Yeah, that's true too.
You know, the Kingpin was basically supposed to be some massive bald mob boss that had really big fists and could fight. Okay. And then, you know, in Daredevil, they turned him into what he is.
Now they've turned him into something else.
Are they really?
Yeah, I think he's. He did a race change.
Really?
Yeah, pretty much. I think so. Yeah, maybe just in the movies, not in the comic books.
Oh,
but yeah, I think so.
Well,
yeah.
Kind of like Nick Fury.
Yeah. And whatever, you know, who cares? But at any rate, yeah. So Miller definitely changed the tone of that book. That might be one of the more, you know, besides Alan Moore, And I guess that's why him and Alan Moore are always like, from that same similar era, and they took a character and just totally messed with it completely and actually improved it in a lot of ways. And then from then on, others did the same thing. But yeah. But I like the fact that they're taking a humorous approach with the books. Why not? I mean, I was reading some of the Jerry Lewis books again, the Jerry Lewis and the Bob Hope books from the 60s by Bob Oxford. And I like humorous superheroes, not in the sense of like what if, not what if, the what the, or some of those where they're just like way over the top. I like when the artist has like a style that can lend itself to action but also be goofy at the same time, because it kind of puts the funny back in the funny books, you know what I mean?
Well, that's one thing Sergio Aragonés, when he was doing Batlash, he was talking about that. He had all these story ideas, and that's where the Batlash series, which you really like, came
yeah,
out.
Oh gosh, yeah.
But at one point, Sergio Aragonés wasn't plotting it anymore, and I guess Nick Carty was still drawing it, but they were showing it, and it was just nothing but zaniness. A lot of pratfalls and silly things here and there, and people didn't like it as much. In an interview, Sergio Aragonés said, "Well, what the problem is even if you're writing a humorous story, you still have to write the story serious, and then just add funny elements around it." And he says, "The problem is what they think is that no joke will go untold, and it's just nothing but silly zaniness. It's not the same." And that's one problem. The Excalibur comic book that Chris Claremont and Alan Davis did together. It was an X-Men spinoff, and I was reading an interview, and Chris Claremont said no joke will go untold, and it was kind of zaniness. And then when Alan Davis came back and wrote it and drew it himself, it still had a light-hearted, fun approach to it, but it was first and foremost just a great storyline, and some of my favorite comics. But that's it. When you're writing something funny, you still put story elements in it, and you make a point, and then you add the lighthearted touch and the fun later.
Yeah, it's what's missing in a lot of books, I mean, you've got like a, you've got, the, even though this is really dark, it's kind of funny in a way what they're doing with the characters, so you kind of like take it with a grain of salt, but this is just like total goofball. So that's kind of good. I like that. I like a change from the grim and gritty and angry and brooding superhero.
I was just thinking, it's funny. Was the foes of Spider-Man?
Superior Foes of Spider-Man. I think it's connected with the Superior Spider-Man.
Well, how many times have you seen a book where it was the bad guys? In the 70s,
Yeah,
they were
remember
doing
the
that.
Secret Society of Supervillains or whatever?
The ones I remember was in, I guess it was end of 74, beginning of 75, DC had that book, The Joker.
Yeah,
Remember that?
Pat's got a reprint book of it. Yeah,
Yeah,
those
on
are
Yancey
good.
Street had one too. See, I bought them.
Those are good. Garcia Lopez worked on those,
Oh,
I
did he
think.
really?
Yeah, I think
I
so.
just remember that was early work. I think Jerry Conway might, or Steve Skates, one of those guys wrote that
Yeah,
book.
sure they did. Yeah.
And but I remember the artwork was kind of simple compared to other people. But I bought it thinking, well, again, I hate to say it, but it was the first issue, so I bought it. But I liked the logo of it, and after a while, it was kind of funny. I remember they had a cartoonist, which is obviously Charles Schulz. And instead of peanuts, he had a strip called cashews. And it showed him at the drawing board, and the way they drew him, though, was like as a very bitter old man, which Charles Schulz was not. But he was sitting
Cashews.
there writing the strip, goes, "Come on, grind, old man, grind." And then he was thinking, 25 years of drawing this trite crap over and over, and I still have to keep coming up with it. So you can basically see whoever the writer was that's his feelings on it. But they showed on the drawing board the strip, and it was two boys like the peanuts. One's looking at, the Charlie Brown character, says, "What was your name?" "Cashews." Or I guess he said cashews. "What was your name again?" "Cashews." And the last panel said Gesundheit.
That was in what book?
Joker.
The Joker had this in
Yeah,
one of the books?
it was in I don't
Oh
know.
God, I gotta find this.
It's
This is
like the third or
bizarre.
it wasn't the first issue. It was like the I don't know how far it went, but
Oh.
and then later the Joker came in and was basically supposed to hold him for ransom. And the Joker told him to basically draw the comic strip to put in the newspaper of the Joker holding him for ransom. And instead of the guy being upset and scared, he just turned around and goes, Joker, shake. And he wanted to shake his hand. It says, 25 years I've been drawing this trite crap. And he said, you know, but, then they talked, and then, you know, the Joker was telling him, after that, you can have me boil him in oil, and, you know, I'll do this and that.
There he goes again, Don.
Sorry.
Dallas, edit that. Anyway.
But, you know, there was fun elements. There was two silly guys in it. One was kind of heavy, and one was thin. They weren't like Abbott and Costello, but I guess that was the routine.
Okay, Laurel and Hardy.
But I guess they were kind of minions, you know, but they were all 70s style. But I just remember they were running through the book, and it was kind of funny. And I remember at one point they had a big map drawn, and it was showing these guys in the actual locations, and the heavy guys yelling out the other guy's name like they were lost. I don't know. It was a book. Sometimes I buy it. And think, why did I buy this? I think one time I got it in one of those three bags that you can get at the grocery store.
Oh, yeah, I love
store.
Those.
But I thought, you know, I read every one of them, but it didn't last a long time. And then I remember Marvel had a book called Supervillain Team-Up.
Yeah, yeah.
And the first issue was a Tuma and Tiger Shark or something. They were underwater, but I think at one point Supervillain Team-Up, yeah, Dr. Doom and Magneto.
Took over, I think.
Yeah, that was, I have to admit, that was kind of a slapstick issue because basically the whole thing was, and Terry Austin, I think, did the cover,
and
part of the
cover.
And
one of those, I believe, Jim Shooter actually drew.
Really?
He drew a comic book once because he thought he could do everything, and it wasn't that great, but it was acceptable, I guess. And it was. I think it was one of those secret society of no. What you said, not secret. I keep thinking
Supervillain
DC.
Team-Up.
Supervillain Team-Up. I keep thinking the DC one. Yeah.
No, but Supervillain Team-Up. I remember one. It was a Magneto and Doctor Doom, but they made Magneto like this goofy, panicky guy, and basically the whole thing was Dr. Doom had taken over the world and nobody knew it, and he was bored, and Magneto faced him and he said, well, I've already taken care of it. No matter what Magneto did, Dr. Doom had something to counteract it.
Huh.
And so basically had a plan. He would give I remember when I'm telling you stories, I read them like 35 years ago. But
yeah, sure.
Dr. Doom basically gave him I don't know, an hour, a day, I don't know what it was, to stop it. And then Magneto's, oh my God, panicking and freaking out, jumping the ship. And I don't know, it had something to do with Jimmy Carter maybe in the White House. But I'm thinking, you know, and then like I said, a couple of years later, he was with the X-Men again, and he was this total Darth Vader, horrific guy you couldn't touch. But I don't know. Comic books with nothing but the bad guys, they've done it. I've read them. But sometimes you're thinking, I don't know, it's just a comic book of nothing but bad guys, that's like a comic book of nothing but superheroes. You know, you need the counteracting.
Yeah, I guess, I think some bad guys may be, like, worse than others. So I guess it's like, I think this is a comedy book.
But that one, I have to admit, looking at it and what you told me, it seems fun. And it seems kind of unique from all the other ones.
Yeah. I mean, it's just, like I said, it's funny. And to me, that's something that's lacking in a lot of the books today. The goofiness.
Yeah, I agree. I like lighthearted stuff.
And speaking of lighthearted stuff, did you hear that Bill Watterson drew three strips recently?
What?
Yes. I'm not going to tell you the whole story because I'm going to screw it up, but it had something to do with the, you know, there's a newspaper strip called Pearls Before Swine?
Yeah, my daughter liked that.
Well, somehow or another, the guy that draws that got in contact with Bill Watterson about an idea that he had, and Watterson actually drew three of the strips. And then I guess the other guy goes back after he's done it. Something about, like, oh, this kid draws better than you or something along those lines. But Google it and find out because it'll give you a better. I know you're a big,
Bill Watterson. Absolutely.
Recently he drew three strips for however long he's been out of it.
Yeah, he did a magazine cover for something. Everybody was freaking out about that.
I guess, if he can draw, why wouldn't you, you know?
Well, he didn't stop. I know he was doing watercolors.
Is that what he went into?
And,
okay.
But like I said, he guards his privacy really strong. Come to find out, the town that he was, I guess he lived at or grew up at, I was reading about it, that all the Calvin Hobbes books are signed by him. And they don't advertise it. But his mother took the books and got him signed, and they sell them in the store.
Huh.
But the store doesn't advertise it. But basically, if you go to the store and buy, hey, this is signed by Will Watterson.
So you're just getting it for like the same price. Or
yeah,
whatever.
But that's, it's just, it's a nice thing. But then I guess people started finding out, flocking there, so that doesn't happen anymore.
That's too bad.
And there was some, I don't know, I found that it was, you could download it from the internet as a podcast. But the guy was basically doing a thing called Finding Mr. Watterson. And, or Finding Calvin Hobbes, I can't remember what it was, but he was going through the town and talking to people. And he never talked to Bill Watterson, of course, but he did talk to his mother, which surprised me. And that last Calvin Hobbes trick where they said, it's all snow, and they said the perimeters are wide open, we can do anything. That was his last strip, and he gave it to his parents. They had it hanging on the wall. But every time she would tell what she could, but I noticed she was making sure she didn't say anything that the son didn't want said. And at one point he asked, you know, the rumors were that he was working on an animated Calvin and Hobbes, but he was doing it himself. And then at one point he asked, what, you know, could I ask what he's doing? And then she was starting to say something. He goes, well, no, I can't. Which, good enough. And but I read before that he was doing watercolors constantly, you know, just birds and stuff like that. I mean, he was a great artist. He was a great writer, and he really made you think. And that strip, I remember when it came out, I just loved it immensely. I've got all the books. I even bought some of the books that had strips already had in it. And I pull them out and read them all the time. It's, when you look at old strips like Little Nemo, you know, the old Gasoline Alley, Captain Easy, all this stuff. And you look at the strips that were running through the 70s all up. And when I say that, I like some of them, like Beetle Bailey and stuff. But you look at those old strips, and the newer strips from the 50s on up just do not hold up. But Calvin Hobbes does, to me.
I like the Far Side.
To me, the best time since I've been alive reading the newspaper was when Calvin Hobbes and the Far Side was in it.
Yeah.
That was the greatest, and I liked For Better, For Worse as well, by Lynn Johnson.
And, of course, The Family Circus.
Oh, I read it, but and I like Doonesbury, too. But, you know, that was the best time. And then when, you know, the guy that did, I can't remember his name, that did Far Side, Gary Larson. Yeah. On the ship, that was in the Stars and Stripes, you know. And you saw those panels cut out and stuck everywhere, on bulkheads on the ship, workspaces. And sometimes, you know, when the planes were gone, there was nothing to do, and, you know, we'd have a little bit of downtime. And we'd all start talking, and it was always Far Side cartoons. Everybody would always bring up about one guy, he just thought the funniest thing was when he said horses are introduced to America. You know, the Europeans came over and brought horses. Well, the Native Americans here never saw a horse before. When they saw them, they thought it was all one being, you know. Well, and Gary Larson, he had a panel that said horses are introduced to America. You see this ship, there's two conquistadors in front of it and two Indians, and there's a horse standing there, and the horse is shaking hands with the Indian. Horses are introduced to and another guy, his favorite was the three bears standing there talking to each other, and one of the bears has a sign taped to his back, and it said shoot me instead of kick me.
Oh, yeah.
It was just, God, there's no strip
like
that.
Yeah, there
were
just some strange strips that guy did, but they were funny. They were different. They were definitely different, but yeah, that guy was really good, and I don't know, you know, they had their moments. All the humor strips had their moments, but I did like Peanuts when I was a kid, though.
Well, see, Peanuts, and Dallas is a huge Peanuts fan. When I was a kid, I liked them. And I see some of those old strips, especially the first 2 years. It was pretty neat.
I didn't like the early ones because his style wasn't loose still. It was still a little tight. I liked it when he loosened up a little bit.
See, I like the older ones because the lines are kind of bold and heavy.
They are, yeah. It's different.
I say this, I really enjoyed reading interviews with Charles Schulz.
Yeah.
I found him extremely interesting and very nice. I just, like I said, all my life, Peanuts was in the paper. It's in the paper to this day. And the only way I can really tell any difference is that his hands got shaky later on and the line was kind of wiggly. But I don't know. And then when he passed away, all I heard was he's a genius and heralded. And when I went to the Cartoon Art Museum in Boca Raton, it was, you know, Peanuts everywhere. And to me, you've seen some, you've seen them all, you know. But
I like them.
Well, I'm, you know, I guess I'm one of the few human beings that feel that way, but I like Charles Schulz. I think it was a great strip. I loved Snoopy when I was a kid.
Yeah.
But no, I've had enough of Peanuts in my lifetime.
I used to buy the little paperbacks,
too. I did, too.
Yeah. Yeah, you know.
And he brought up some stuff. I remember when I was a kid, I was reading them. One of their friends was a kid, and his name was Five. And they kept asking him. It ran for a long time. And they said, why did your dad name you Five? And they said, well, my dad had so many kids, he got tired of naming them, so he just started issuing numbers to us. And I guess, you know, he was number Five. But the way it sounded like, the kids went up to 20.
That's like George Foreman's kids.
That's not clued the kids that came before him. But I don't know. It was just some really wild stuff all the time like that, that it made you think, you know, but...
Yeah, it is what it is. Like I said, I liked it as a kid. When I got older, I just didn't... Yeah, it didn't have the same appeal to me.
Me too.
But as a kid, I really enjoyed it a lot.
But going back to Bill Watterson, Charles Schulz is one of his strongest influences.
I'm sure.
So, you know, but if you look at the strips, they're completely different, but, you know...
So do you want to talk about any funny books, man?
Well, you brought up something else. It was basically you found an issue and it made you want to go. You had no idea what was going on, but you wanted to go back to some of the other ones.
Mm-hmm.
That's growing up. That's how it always was. You buy a random issue and what is this? But you jumped in.
That's how I roll, man.
And sometimes I found that what I had in my head was more interesting than what actually went on before. Because, you'd buy an issue of, you know, say the 1970s Captain Marvel, you know, that Jim Starlin did and Gil Kane. You buy one issue, wow, this is incredible. And you start wondering how he got to that point and what happened, this and that. And next thing you know, you find these old issues. Maybe not so interesting, you know. And but what you put in your head, it was far better. Sometimes it's fun to fill in the holes yourself.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know, you know, but it's a way to get started with a book, which is something that, you know, I think people should do. Just pick up a random comic book, and just pick it up. You know, just go, hey, that looks good. I'm gonna read it. Don't necessarily just go, well, I need to get this because it's a continuum. Just pick up a random comic book, because that way, you may find something that you like, and it might stimulate your comic book reading, and it might get you to. You know, purchase more books or whatever. You know, we're becoming too much of a subscription pull service, you know, society where it's like, you know, you get the books saved for you and, you know, here they are and it's a continuing or whatever. I'm different. Like you said, I like to go to it's like going to the newsstand and just picking up something off the rack.
Well, I do like
in the middle of a storyline.
I do subscribe, but I don't particularly like to. The reason I do is nobody orders the books I like, so I have to make sure I get them.
Nobody can afford to get every comic book.
Right.
That's the problem, too.
Well, I don't get every comic book. I don't really get that many.
But it would have. They would have to in a lot of ways, you know.
But there are books I find off the stands. That's where I discovered Chris Samnee when he was doing Thor the Mighty Avenger.
Yeah,
I never would have ordered that book. So sometimes you find it. Well, speaking of that, Company Ice and I went to Wilson's Book World the other day. Everything, all these old issues are a dollar. And I got a small stack that I haven't read.
Well, you picked up Nightcrawler 1. See, you picked up 2 and then you went back and got number 1.
Yeah, well, I bought 2 from my Comic World. And I liked it. I found number 1. I haven't read it yet.
Secret Avengers.
Secret Avengers, I like the cover design. I like how they did the logo and I like the drawing style. This is the first one. I saw the second one. But the second was on the wall. And when I bought this, I told the guy at the store, wait a minute, I didn't think this really belonged in the dollar box, but I saw it in 3 different places in the dollar box. Yeah, it seems new. Yeah, nobody's buying it. I just threw it in there. So hopefully the second issue will be there. I don't know. It caught me. I wouldn't have bought it full price. I haven't read it yet, but I like the look of it. And I like how they did the logo.
Oh, okay. But the Nightcrawler, you were looking for it.
Yeah, and I found that, and I'm happy. And Chris Samnee did the cover.
All right. What else you got? Power Bureau, what's that?
Okay, there was, what's that guy's name? Michael Oeming and Brian Bendis. Back in the 90s, they were doing a black and white comic called Powers. I can't remember who published it. But it looked like the Bruce Timm Batman animated series style.
It does look like it a little bit, yeah.
and I would pick one up and glance at it, but I'd always leave it in the store. And I was at the time, I think it might have been a black and white book, but somebody at work had read some. He goes, "It looks like a kid's book. Don't think it is. It has no business being in that style." Really? And then I've heard, I like Michael Ohme, and I read Hammer of the Gods that he drew, you know, that Viking story. He did a couple of those. And, of course, Brian Bendis has gotten to be a really famous writer.
Yeah.
But I started going in old back issue bins and finding Powers. And basically it's a world where superheroes are real. But they started, I don't know if they were, it's kind of like Watchmen and all the other stuff where they had acts where superheroes were either controlled and licensed or outlawed. But basically the main cop of this, he's kind of like a FBI, you know, he deals with superheroes. He was super himself and he lost his powers.
Mm.
And so basically they're always solving murders and finding people.
Okay.
And I'll tell you, it's drawn in a cartoony style, but it's brutal. But the one problem I have with it was, I go through these dollar back issues. I've got a stack of these, but they were with one publisher, and then they went to another publisher, I think, and I guess they started reprinting the old issues. Sometimes I don't really know where I'm at with the numbering, and it's like I'm reading different storylines from different times, and they don't, you know, coincide. And now Icon, which I guess is Marvel's creator-owned thing.
Is that what that is?
Yeah. I bought the first issue years and years ago, and these two are Icon. I haven't read these yet, but I will. But it's a good series.
It looks good.
It is good. I just wish I knew exactly who published when what.
You got the Marvel Knight X-Men? Or
okay. They had three issues of this in the dollar bin. I bought them because I bought one because I liked the cover. I liked, again, the logo design and how they drew the cover. The insides is written and drawn by the same guy. I'm trying to think of his name here.
It's either Chris Peter or Bram.
Bram Ruppel.
Yeah.
Yeah. He wrote the story and art. Christiane Peter, I guess, colored it. Again, I haven't read these. The company Ice is making fun of me because he's an X-Men guy. He says, "You're crossing over the dark side?" Listen, I was an X-Men fan before Company Ice was born.
That's right.
But I just, you know, once in a while
before
I'll pick
up. Before John Byrne got there.
Yeah. But once in a while, you know, there's an issue that they've done that I like and I'll pick it up. And this one, like I said, I got three issues. I kind of want to look at it. And again, seeing the art style, even though it's nothing like I draw, it made me want to draw. So
that is a good thing.
Yeah. Which is why I bought all these.
Because you like the style they're drawn in. And if it's a good comic book, yeah. Hey. You'll keep reading, and if it's not, at least it was only a dollar. Are they putting in new stuff in the dollar bin at Wilson's?
Yeah,
okay.
There was a lot of stuff I haven't seen.
Oh, okay, well, that's good. That's good to know. Yeah, I mean, it makes sense. If a book is on a shelf and there's no room, you got to get rid of it somehow or another.
Well, and like I said, even not just the new stuff and some of the other things, there's books that I haven't seen before.
Okay.
You know, I mean, it's just, you know, it's sometimes it's the same stuff, but sometimes you find other things in it.
Still those dwindling boxes of Archie still there? Is that almost done?
Yeah, but it's never dwindling. It's always more.
There's always more? Oh, okay. I didn't realize
Every
that.
Time I walk in there, they have some more stuff. Now they have some of the Disney ducks. I noticed they were in the front of the Archies, but not a lot of them. But every time I go in there, Al and I dig through the Archies, I'm always finding Dan DiCarlo issues, and once in a while I'll find a Harry Lucy.
Yeah.
And but I always walk out with mostly Archies when I go there, but this time I just didn't feel like it, so I got a pile I'm really happy with, but I never looked in the Archies. If I had, I would have bought twice as much.
There you go.
But
anything else?
Well, yeah, I'm sure everybody's tired of hearing about Jacob Kurtzberg's and Stanley Lieber's Fantastic Four.
Yeah, and the lawsuit, or you
talk? No,
oh, okay.
The masterwork. I finished five, and it goes all the way to the Galactus trilogy. The third book of the Galactus trilogy goes to the next issue, or the next book. But, you know, as I've always said, reading these in sequence, there's things that happened I didn't realize. I didn't know that they found the Inhumans before the Galactus trilogy.
Yeah.
And I didn't know the Medusa was with the Frightful Four.
Yeah.
I never really knew exactly why, but she started out as a bad guy, and then somehow, I found out about the Inhumans. Never knew the story. But this one, the Frightful Four is there. It just keeps going on. And then they start realizing that they're friends with Medusa. And then Gorgon shows up, starts destroying New York City. And then Johnny Storm sees Crystal right away. I didn't know that.
And he falls for her.
Falls for her, she falls for him immediately. Love at first
And then
sight.
that big dog.
Yeah, Lockjaw.
Lockjaw, yeah.
And then they meet Black Bolt, who is super awesome.
Oh,
And
yeah.
but I'll be honest with you, I always loved the Inhumans, not really knowing what they were, but they just Medusa just fascinated me as a kid when I'd see her in like at Six Flags Over Texas, there was a big store called the Emporium in one section, and it was basically a giant head shop at a they had ZZ Top posters and everything else. And I remember in the mid-70s they had a early 70s they had a square wax candle with Medusa on the front from Marvel Comics, and it just fascinated me that her mask, her living hair, everything is just beautiful and scary at the same time. But Black Bolt, every time I'd read the Inhumans comic, the ones George Perez drew, I said, "What is Black Bolt? What does he do?" Because they always talk about how awesome he is and how they all fear him. But I was telling one of my friends in middle school, I said, "But what is it? What does he do?" "He could fly." "Well, that's it? I mean, I'm sorry. It would be cool if he could fly."
But if he opens his mouth, it's like.
Well, yeah, he has that supersonic thing. He can't talk. But even then, he doesn't ever use it. He can fly. But in the Fantastic Four, they kind of explain what it is, that he's really strong, he's really fast, and Reed Richards figures out he has that antenna on his head.
The tuning fork.
Yeah, the tuning fork, which I thought that had something to do with the sound, but basically he's taking particles in the air and he builds up into the super energy. That's where he gets his speed and his strength. But after a bit he wears it out. And but like I said, it starts out with, Maximus, his brother's got the crown. They're trying to hide from humanity, found out the humans aren't their enemies. Maximus builds this weapon. And it basically it vibrates the atmosphere, and it's supposed to wipe out the human race, and then the Inhumans take over. Gotten to find out it didn't. It shook the Earth, but it didn't kill the humans. That's when the Inhumans realized that they weren't really any different. So that was it. Maximus uses the gun, creates that dome over the Great Refuge. The Fantastic Four escapes. Crystal stays there. Johnny Storm freaks out. Then they go back to New York. The sky's on fire, and the Silver Surfer shows up.
Yeah.
So basically, that's why the Silver Surfer found Earth, because Maximus had that vibrating gun. It vibrated the atmosphere, brought the attention to it. I never knew all that. Whenever I've seen these reprints of the Galactus trilogy, they
You
cut
haven't
out.
read before, you
Yeah,
just
they
read.
always cut out that first part because it's all in that 48th issue. But they cut that part out, so you always read right after that happens, where the sky is on fire and the Silver Surfer comes down. Oh, well, that's kind of awesome, don't you think? And that's why Reed was, as Dallas always brings up, didn't shave because he was locked away finding out why the sky was on
You remember
fire.
those issues where he was like, oh, I've been in the negative zone, or I've been here,
Yeah.
and he's got that
Which
stubble.
I loved, and I loved it when the Inhumans showed up with him all the time. And then, I've thumbed through it, but after this, that's when they find the Black Panther. I'll tell you what, I don't.
That's the primo time of that
That is
book.
the primo time. And I've heard people complain at the later issues that they weren't as good because Jack Kirby was holding back and saving his work for the Fourth World. But, even up to the last issue he drew, the artwork is just stunning. I posted one of the on the earlier blog post. But it's where Crystal was giving the thing some medicine, and she was holding his nose and giving him the spoon with the medicine in it. Fantastic drawing, Jack Kirby was just, he was, and they always talk about, that's what made it great, was Stan Lee was channeling Jack Kirby's creative peak. And nothing like him. It was the world's greatest comic book.
For a while there, yeah.
Yeah, for 102 issues.
At least.
Yeah.
Yeah. But of those one or two issues, those were probably some of the greatest ones.
Yeah, and the next Masterworks, number six, like I said, when I thought five would be the one to get, and it is good, but it's number six is the one that I got that in the mailbox. I opened it up, thumbed through it when I took the dog outside. And next thing you know, oh my God, I got to go to class. I had to put it down. I couldn't put it down. And that has the issue that I think made you, yeah, it
Yeah,
brought you
it's
into
having that
comics.
box in there,
67.
57.
Or was it 57?
Yeah, Enter Dr. Doom, yeah.
With the Silver Surfer,
He's
yeah.
got all of them like floating around his big old iron face.
Yeah, but I mean, the Black Panther, everything was in it. And like I said, I never saw Jack Kirby look better. I never saw Joe Sinnott look better. Everything was hitting on all cylinders. Which you guys will be hearing another issue, another episode.
So I mean, this is gonna be you're gonna go through every issue of the FF as we
Yeah.
go along. So,
Yeah, once I completed it, that's when I started
but we won't
reading
have that on the next episode because you won't be on it. So it'll be two episodes from now.
it.
You'll get more FF talk, but next one you won't. I may mention it, but we'll see what happens. But that's pretty cool what you're doing though, because you're getting a recap of the greatness of the FF, which means that all of you out there should buy these
Yeah, I
books.
can't recommend it enough. It's fun. If you can find reprints of this stuff and read them in sequence, there's nothing like
Right on,
it.
man. What else? What else is there, Don? Is there anything that we need to say?
I think we've said
We
enough.
exhausted our comic book allotment of time. All right. Well, then I guess we should be saying goodbye then.
Take care.
You can find Al's other podcast, Slow Robot Agogo, Dallas's webcomic, The Mighty Blue, and Al's blog, Destination Nightmare, on the sidebar of our blog at bunchofdorks.com.
And click on the Cyclops.